Blog Talk Radio.
Reno 3-1, flat of 4, Point India. Reno 3-1, flight, for Point Juliet.
Listening to Patriot Nation Radio Live, 347-637-3942.
Welcome. Welcome to the Patriot Nation show, the American Allegiance show, okay? It's Wednesday night again, and here we are. We're going to talk about this war in Ukraine. First, let's do the promo.
You are listening to Patriot Nation Radio Live, 347-637-3942.
That's right, 347-637-3942. That's the number, 347-637-3942. Thanks, Dr. Drake. I learned from you. So tonight we're talking about the Ukrainian war, and actually we're going to talk about maybe the hardware and the aircraft and things on the ground, and I have a couple of guests tonight that are going to talk about it, and I'm excited to have former F-16 pilot Brad Gland to join us tonight and talk about some things that we may not know about, nothing classified, but as a matter of fact, he is a combat veteran in the F-16 in the war with Iraq, and I'll introduce you. This is Brad Gland, Major, is that correct?
Yeah.
So welcome
to the
Kevin? Show.
Thanks it's for having me on, man.
I am happy to have you on again. I had you on a few months ago, sometime last year, and it was a great show, highly rated. Everybody likes the fighter pilot, right? The macho thing and everything. And there are female fighter pilots, and, you know, there are people of all kinds are up there. There are doctors. There are attorneys. All kinds of people are flying on the weekends, and they're flying your airlines as well. So very diverse group of people, especially when they're in the Guard or Reserve, they have that ability to do that. So you never know who's going to fly your plane on your next trip. But so, Brad, we're talking about this war in Ukraine. And just at first glance, what are your thoughts of you know, what's going on? And the big call, one of the reasons I'm having you on here is people think that planes are going to fix all the problems with Ukrainians and everything. So what's your assessment of that? Is that even feasible? I don't even know if the airports are open or they're occupied.
Yeah. You know, I was just thinking about this when we were talking before the show started. But, you know, a lot of those guys, you know, the Su-35 guys and the MiG-29 guys, got to be a lot like it is in the States, where there's only a handful probably of pilot training bases, so chances are a lot of those guys probably know each other or, you know, have a lot of friends in common. So, you know, when they're, I think about going up and flying, and you could be with a guy that was in your pilot training class, you know, going up to mix it up with somebody that you were friends with at one point. That kind of just hit me just a minute ago, thinking that something like that could happen. But, yeah, I don't, I, you know, talking about, like, the Ukrainians flying the MiG-29s and going up against the far more capable Su-35, you know, anybody that's willing to get airborne in a MiG-29 against, when they know they're outmatched, is, has my respect for sure.
Right. And I had the chance to, I went to Hungary in, right before 9/11, we did a trip over there. We got to see the MiG-29s up close. And, yeah, you know, it's like, it seems like it's F-4 technology, what we looked at, it, those were built back in the 70s. There's a lot of issues with them. Half the planes are broke most of the time, and that's including with a lot of the other countries that have them, and they seem to be wanting to give them away. And that's why Poland says, hey, you can have ours, because they don't want them anymore. Hungary was trying to get rid of theirs, too, at the time we were there. They wanted to get something else. But this is the thing. Everybody thinks that this is the magic bullet for Ukraine. And like you said earlier, the Su-35 is a whole other generation aircraft. So in my experience, I remember when the F-15E came out, we would go on these exercises where everybody who was not the F-15E could not see the F-15E, and they would all get shot down instantly. They had not even a contest. And I have this feeling that because Russia does not give the other countries they give the MiG-29s to the best of the aircraft or capabilities, they just give them a bare bones. You can put these on it. And that's usually what the U.S. does as well. You're going to get F-16s from them. You're going to get these F-16s. Unless you're a wealthy Arab nation, you're going to get the I'm not going to say dumbed down, but you're going to get the lesser version, the less effective, so you cannot fight the Americans. And we constantly upgrade our aircraft, and they don't. So it's just a fact that I don't believe, this is my thesis, that this will not help the Ukrainians fight the Su-35s. So I want your take on that.
Well, yeah, like I said, you know, being a pilot and you have the airframe that you have to be smart and try to exploit your advantages over whatever aircraft that you're fighting. And you also have to try to minimize areas where maybe they have the advantage. And so it's a lot like a chess match, which is ironic because my girlfriend's listening and her son, who's 7, routinely crushes me in chess. So, but anyway, a plane is a tool, okay? Yeah, certain tools are better for certain jobs, but to be completely honest, the biggest factor is the guy in the cockpit or gal.
Okay.
You know, that's what makes or breaks an aircraft. I mean, you can fly a MiG-29 against a Su-35. You're certainly not going to go to a visual merge with them because with those forward canards, when he gets below 300 knots, those start to dig in, and he can slew that nose around. Plus, they've got vector thrust. Unless you've got some high-off foresight, heat-seeking missile, you're not going to win that one. So, you know, just thinking about it, like, how would I go into this if I was a Ukrainian going up against a Su-35? I would probably have two ships, one guy high, two guys low, try to sneak somebody in the middle of their formation, hopefully get lost in the ground clutter. Because if, you know, they just absolutely cannot go to a visual merge with these guys, they're going to it's not going to go well. So, you know, it's very much a tactical thing. You know, you have to think about, you know, how you want to try to scenario manage and to gain the advantage. And there isn't a lot of advantages to be had when you're talking MiG-29 versus a Su-35. They've got the better radar. They've got the better avionics. They've got I'm curious to know, Kevin, I peeked inside of a MiG-29 before. It just looks like the engineers just put things wherever is convenient. It's not set up in any way for the pilot, you know, to be able to do a good visual scan and know, you know, whether you're getting lit up on the RWR, or if you're heads down in the radar, there's just no good scan pattern. At least that's what I saw. What was your take on that?
I noticed the engineering. The plane is not. It's not solid, in my opinion. I mean, it's not tight like the F-16. The surfaces, everything like that. I thought it was. We were going back in time. It wasn't anything modern really about it. It's just like I said. It was like an old F-4. It's a basic aircraft, and it's not very reliable. You have a lot of problems with it, and like you said before, and also it's very, very expensive to operate. And so this is why people are getting away from it. And like you said earlier, it's just that makes a lot of sense. These people probably trained with the Russians. They probably know some of those Russians in the other aircraft. And that's very likely. And that may be one reason why they're not doing anything, because, I mean, we did the Dutch training in Ohio, and we trained other pilots in Tucson. And we're using their aircraft and flying with them and training them, so they know their tactics. That's the other thing.
That would be the weird part, is going up against guys that are trained the same as you, but yet there could be guys, like I said, I don't know how many pilot training bases they have in the former Soviet Union. I know we've got kind of three main ones in the U.S. and everybody, all the pilots kind of know, you could name any squadron in the world, and I probably know two or three dudes there because of going through pilot training exercises, instructor pilot upgrade, that kind of stuff. So, it just seems like you kind of sound like a Civil War type, you have brother against brother kind of thing.
Absolutely. And the other factor, I don't know if you knew this, but every plane or every MiG, held by every other country, they sign agreements for parts, to get parts. And when they can get parts, and parts are very hard to come by on the MiG-29, so once you get it, you sign this paperwork saying that you won't use it against the Soviet Union. And all your parts come from the Soviet Union, so you can't get them anywhere else. So that's another catch there. Where, I mean, there's really not much they could do. It could be a sustained war at all. Once the parts on this unreliable aircraft, go out, you're done.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
I remember
parts break a lot. Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Excuse me. No, I remember, when you were the pro soup and I was scheduling, and I'm like, hey, can we run an 8-turn-6? And you're like, I've got how about a 6-turn-4? Like, well, we need 8 aircraft to do a 4v4 for upgrade ride. It's the same thing. I mean, except this is, the real deal. I mean, if you're going to try to strike back against Russia, you have to have effective and fully mission-capable aircraft. If you don't have that, good luck. You're already starting off behind the 8-ball, going up against a more advanced aircraft, and then, if
Absolutely.
You only can do it with a 2-ship or a 3-ship, you're really, really in a bad way.
Yeah, that's one of the issues they have. And I think we're analyzing this. We're maybe overanalyzing it, but just to let the public know, these are real issues and logistics that people never think about. You can't just give them aircraft. Some of these aircraft may be configured differently. They were talking about giving them F-16s, and they have not trained in any F-16s, okay? You can't just get in a plane and take off and fly it without training. So there's a lot of things that don't make sense or can't make sense without using logic and knowledge. We have that knowledge. A lot of people don't. It takes a long time to get trained in something new, a new platform, we call it.
Yeah.
So that's one of the factors. I mean, there's so many things. I don't think the airports are even open. So, and here's the deal is this. If you get them from Poland, then, that's from a NATO country. That's another thing you don't want to do either. I mean, you don't want to cause WW3. I mean, then they attack Poland, it's over now.
For sure.
So it's so complicated. And, you know, I don't know. I can't see them, even with the aircraft. That's just my opinion.
Yeah. You know, the only thing, like, it would be a big kind of morale win, kind of like the whole Doolittle raid when, you know, we were able to launch some aircraft and strike back. You know, that was a huge public relations thing. It boosted morale. Everybody felt good about it. You know, if the Ukrainians were able to shoot down a couple of aircraft, you know, that would give them something to kind of rally behind, I think. But that would be, you know, because that's a big ask. And anybody that's willing to sign up for that sort of event has my respect, for sure.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the coast of Kiev.
Yeah, you hear all those.
Yes. Yeah, you know this better than I do, but when I was a young guy with DA-7, and after we got the F-16 for a while, there are people who became one with the aircraft, and they're like Ghost of Kiev kind of people. And, you know, they're amazing guys. I mean, the guys that nothing phases them, they get the job done, and they're having fun. And they know that aircraft inside and out, and they can fly it like nobody else. Those kind of people are like the guy in Kiev. So, like you said, it all comes down to the pilot. Because some people might hate it.
You definitely have guys that are like beyond. They can have the aircraft do things that technically you should not be able to do. I flew with a couple of those guys, and you know, you watch the tapes after you've had the engagement. You're like, I literally don't know how you did what you just did with the airplane. And you know, those are the kind of guys that you kind of draw yourself to, you learn from them, develop your skills through that. Anybody can go out and fly a sortie, debrief it, you know, and get points from it. But the guys like that, the ones that they're able to do things they shouldn't be able to do, those are the ones that I was always drawn to, trying to, you know, understand, like, you know, hey, teach me, make me better. You know, I'm here, I'm open book, just, you know, let me learn. There was a guy, his call sign was PK. He was a former Thunderbird, and he was one of my instructors in RTU. And so we went out on a defensive BFM sortie. So I'm supposed to be out front jinking, trying to defeat his gunshot, you know, and he's back there. And I'm not even kidding you, Kevin. This guy literally mashed me roll for roll, and the pipper never, ever came off my aircraft. And I just was sitting in that debrief so dejected. I'm like, you know, it takes 15 rounds for a kill. This dude probably had 5,000. I mean, it literally, the pipper never came off my aircraft. And I'm like, I know I'm going to fail the ride. I know I'm going to have to see it again. And he goes, at the end of the debrief, I'm preparing myself for, hey, sorry, dude, you're going to have to see this ride again. He's like, nah, man. He goes, your jinx were good. I was just better. And I'm like... Yeah, he goes, there are probably only a handful of people in the Air Force that can do what I just did. I'm like, okay, well, I guess it makes me feel a little bit better. But, yeah, this guy, and he was one of those guys. He was awesome at what he did. And I believe he's flying for the airlines now, which seems like a tremendous waste of talent. But,
yeah.
You know, the money's good, so.
The money's great, yeah. Yeah, I knew guys like that when I first got in. That were incredible, and I've even seen the tanker guys do that, some of them. I mean, they knew what they were doing. They were part of the aircraft. So
yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, there's guys on the maintenance side, I'm sure, that are the very same way.
Yeah. And it's a good thing, you know. The maintenance guys that are like that, I mean, we had the best people in the world. We had machinists, welders. We had people that could do anything, all in one unit or whatever, and they were all skilled, and we had, like, some of them have 30 years of experience, electricians, all kinds of people. So it was a city of it by itself. We could self-sustain anywhere in the world with these people and fix everything we needed to. So hats off to people dedicated to their job, completely dedicated. It's
absolutely
not like the airline world, completely different. It's a job.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah, for sure.
We'd like to know what it's like to fly in combat.
So I'm going to caveat this with saying we were mostly we were all air to ground in Iraq anyway. It really was no air threat, but the Iranians would mess with us from time to time. They'd light us up if we were working on in the northeast portion of Iraq. They'd light us up with their early warning and their target acquisition and see if they could make a stance, see if they could fool us into doing something stupid, starting World War III, that kind of thing. I mean, it would be very easy to just where you're at and go into Iranian airspace, and then at which time they have every right to prosecute. They would make spoofer radio calls, tell us they're scrambling their alert jets. So we would mess with them. We'd get a two-ship line abreast, climb up high, drive towards, and then hook away in the last minute just to mess with them. But, it was just, they play their games, we play ours. The biggest thing when you're flying in combat, there is not a down moment. Like, your brain is in high gear, running full steam ahead. From the minute you put the gear in the well till you taxi in. I mean, you still have to de-arm the aircraft. There's still live missiles, live guns, live bombs on that jet. So, you literally can't take a breath and relax until that aircraft is shut down and you shake the crew chief's hand and fill out your 781. I mean, that's... And then it's like your brain just it just shuts down. But, I mean, that's the one thing I remember more than anything, because you're just on point the entire time because, it's just a no-fail mission. I mean, you have so much going on. If you're not juggling four or five or six things at one time, you're probably falling behind. And that's the thing that stuck with me the most is you function at such a high level and, there's just no time for anything other than, trying to stay ahead of the jet, making sure you're making your air refueling time, making sure you're in your airspace, trying to keep track of your wingman, working with the tanker and the guys on the ground, the JTACs and everyone like that. You're just busy, man.
Yeah, and you got a lot of stuff to do. There's a lot of cockpit management people don't realize. Could you go through that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, you plan, you brief, you have everything kind of as much as you can squared away before you even step to the jet. We'd have 30 sheets of paper with imagery and call signs and code words and all this stuff that Intel works for hours to generate. And literally you'd be taxiing out, like, hey, contact Warhawk for your retasking. You take your 30 sheets of paper, you turn it over to the blank side, and then you write down what you're really going to go out and do that day. That was almost, more the rule than the exception. I mean, it was very rare to go out on a mission, as fragged. I mean, you almost always ended up going someplace for troops in contact or doing some... convoy escort. We did a lot of that, looking for IEDs, if they had a string of Humvees going down, like the road, we could use our sensors to see if we could find those and stop them, so hopefully save some lives, that kind of thing. It was just, you have to be adaptable, improvise, adapt, overcome. It's not, if you are not flexible, if you're not adaptable, then that is the wrong job for you.
Right. Yes. Yeah, and you also have a lot of instrumentation to deal with. You have to know how, there's so many things in that system and on the screens that you have to know, you have to master pretty much. Because it's the mission, it's your life, it's how you get back and everything. You have to be the navigator, you got to be the weapons guy. There's nobody in the back seat, and it's all up to you. And you have to manage the fuel and the weapons and everything else. And communication.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that was, that's the thing. It's like a single-seat fighter, man. I mean, you're the hero or zero. If you do it right, then you're the hero. If you screw it up, there's nobody to blame but yourself. I mean, it's high-risk, high-reward scenario, for sure.
Yes, absolutely. And then, I saw on YouTube... last year or so, something about these pods, and this is all public information. It's amazing. You can see for tens of miles, like you're even, like you're right there, wherever you're going. It's incredible. So I saw the demos on that. You don't have to comment on it, but I think the technology is unreal in these modern aircraft.
And yeah, you're talking about the targeting pods?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah,
it looks like you're there.
It is. The pods that we flew with were fantastic. Day, night, didn't matter. You could see, it's pitch black. I mean, zero starlight, zero moonlight, zero cultural lighting on the ground. I mean, you could see, like it was day. Obviously not color, but, different polarities and all this stuff. And again, I've been out of the game for a while. I'm sure there's a better one out there now than when I was in. And there was such a huge integration. American pilots, we have a lot of our avionics are integrated in with the J-Hemix. Now you've got all the information in the helmet. Multi-function displays, HSD, all that stuff, Link 16, all of that stuff. And I wonder, the Russians were messing around with some of that stuff, and I wonder how much of that has been integrated in say, the Su-35. Do they have the ability to receive off-board information, that kind of thing? So,
I would think so, yes.
And when I was in, the Su-35 was just really kind of like an air show thing. Like, hadn't really operationally deployed it. They used it as a propaganda tool. People watch it do really crazy things at air shows and be like, oh, we're scared of this airplane. Now it's operationally fielded, and I just wonder how much of that stuff, worked its way into the avionics and whatnot. That's an answer I don't have.
No, I don't know that either, I guess we could assume that they do have that capability. I'm sure they have people here that, at Lockheed, who knows? So you just never know. But, yeah, that's amazing how that works and the technology. And so this is what I'm saying. The reason I'm saying this is not in the MiG-29, the stuff you talked about. I mean, I've seen the cockpit. I've been up the stairs and ladders, and when I saw, it was a basic F-4 type aircraft. It had instruments and everything, but it did not have anything I could tell that was worth, the same kind of value. Like, there's no pods on it; it just flew. And big, billowing black smoke, just like an F-4, every takeoff. And one of the maintenance guys, and who worked with the maintenance guys for it? The whole time we were there, I was in charge of maintenance. I was the liaison. So they had to change the battery every time the plane landed, which is crazy. So how long would that plane be out? You're going to run out of the batteries eventually, or you're going to have to charge them up. So there's a lot of issues. This is why people hate that aircraft. This is not the savior of anybody.
Yeah.
If Russia gives them away, then that tells you something.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like the MiG-29, like it's fourth gen barely. If you look at like the Su-35, you're talking like 4+. That's like the only thing it really doesn't have to make it fifth gen is stealth. Intentional stealth built from the ground up with the intention of being low observable, and a synthetic aperture radar. That's kind of the big two things it doesn't have. Other than that. It's pretty close. I mean, it's probably pretty close to like our Block 60, something like that.
Right.
Whereas the MiG-29 is kind of like A7 F4-ish. So, as far as capabilities and the avionics.
And it also was, I understand, I read that it was probably on par with the early F-16, the very early F-16. Which are nothing like the ones of today.
Yeah, for sure.
And now we're developing the F-15EX and the F-16 improved Viper with the static radar. So, I mean, things just get better. That's what I like about America. You're not happy with what you have. You move forward. You make things better. They're constantly upgrading these aircraft. Every time there's a mod, it's like, okay, we got to do this mod or that mod. But you know what? It's for our good. Nobody else can touch us. You have F-16s, but you don't have ours. That's the thing.
Yeah.
So the way that we take things very seriously, and you know, honestly, compared to other air forces, and I've worked with NATO air forces before, it's just not the same. The level of the level of care and concern and defense-minded. I mean, we're in it to win it. I'll say that, because other countries, not so much. I know you probably flew with the Dutch a little bit, Dutch Air Force.
Yeah.
I don't know if you did or not.
Yep.
It's a different world. I mean, NATO is actually, in my opinion, is the United States. NATO is not all the other countries. I've dealt with a couple of them, and it's just not the same. It's not the same drive. Maintenance isn't the same. The pilots aren't the same. They've got good pilots. Don't get me wrong, but now they have F-35s, but it's about the same.
Yeah, for sure. You know, that's the thing, man. You know, as a pilot, you have to have a good jet, and but that comes from your guys' side, where, you know, you take pride in the aircraft. It looks and flies like it's supposed to, you know, and every single time I got in that aircraft, I didn't care if it was cold, windy, raining, foggy, whatever, I always went up, shook the crew chief's hand, you know, before the flight, you know, thanks for getting it ready. After the flight, thanks for a good jet. I think the only time I said something to crew chiefs after was I had a cycling ECS. So the whole, like, I think it was a 5-hour sortie I did with the surging ECS. So pressure, no pressure. Pressure, no pressure. Pressure. And by the end of that day, I had such a headache.
That's your
like, thanks, bro. Yeah. Thanks for that, man.
Yeah, so that hit on one of my systems. Yeah. That was one of my systems. Yeah, those are surge problems or just a big nuisance. I prefer not anybody to fly in it because you don't have your cabin pressure right. So yeah. As far as the absolutely, you have to have good planes, and I think I did a great job while I was there as Pro Super. We had a record number of aircraft available for you guys, so I learned a lot, and it was the best job I ever had, so working with the best people.
Well, but then you had me, too, and I was the exception to that rule.
No, I think, you know, it was cool because, no, you were good. No, there's things you have to do to make it happen, and you had everything sewed up, so I didn't have any problems there. You're the scheduler. So what we're talking about is pilots aren't just pilots. They do other duties as well in the squadron, and they have responsibilities outside of being a pilot, and this is one of yours with the scheduler. You gave us the pilots that I gave the plane, and then we work together to make that happen every day. Every single day you got to do this. You got to plan for the next day on the day that you fly. So there's a lot of things going on while you're doing the rest of the maintenance, while you're planning everything. So it's a machine that, and when you're flying like two or three sorties a day or two or three goes a day, there's a lot of work behind it with mechanics and everything. And this is what makes us different from the airlines, which I worked at the airlines for 3 years. You have to be, you're constantly busy. Nobody has time to rest. You got to get stuff done. And that's even, when I gave a speech out in Naples last April, that's one of the things I put in front of everybody with the F-16s taking off, three different goes in Alpena every day. And people are constantly on the flight line going stuff, and the pilots are in the briefings and everything. It is all business. It's not just a job that you fix the planes at night. This is dedication to the highest level because it's that important. And you realize what you're doing when you get overseas and you're representing the United States of America. And the flag's on your shoulder, it's on the aircraft. And what you're doing is you're defending the Constitution and pretty much the world when you're out there. People look up to us. That's who we are. The other countries are like, oh, yeah, this is Big Brother. They're here. We're happy they're here. And you go places, and they already have aircraft, but, you know, they want you there. They don't want their people to send. They're counting on us. And we are the threat. We're standing in the way of not having freedom. So this is very important. Army, Air Force, Navy, Marines, we all do the same thing. So I thank you for your service and what you do. And like I always say, we go to another country away from the combat while the fighter pilots go in and into the combat. That's the difference between us and the other services. The fighter pilots are doing the fighting. So thank you for your service. You guys had a lot of risk and a lot of things that we don't have to deal with. So and that's aside. When the plane takes off, we don't know where it goes. We don't know what they're doing. We just see that the bombs are gone later when they come back. And this is real life. This is something that people don't think about. It's not a game or anything. This is truth. This is consequences here for not doing the right thing, for not being integrity. So can you speak on that?
Yeah, you know, the first thing that comes to mind, I mean, you know, obviously – is thank you for being able to generate, get us the aircraft that we need to be able to do what we need to do. You know, I'm only half joking when I say that, you know, a pilot without a jet is just a really, really good-looking pedestrian. It's only kind of partially a jest because it's true. I mean, without it, we're just kind of sitting there with nothing to do. So, you know, we feel that. We appreciate that. We don't ever tell you guys that, because that's just not how pilots and maintainers are.
Oh, that's, expected.
And then the other thing is when I would get, like, when we would go, we'd take off in Iraq, you'd sit there and you're in the EOR waiting for your number two to get armed up or whatever. The one thing I felt was just this immense sense of responsibility. Because here I am sitting in this jet, on the ramp, on top of this enormous pile of man hours of all of the work that every different career field has done to get this aircraft to be ready to go, and how I'm responsible to use it the way it's supposed to be used, to not waste the time of all these people that put so much love, care, effort, blood, sweat, tears, all that stuff into that aircraft. You know, it happened in combat. It happened during an ORI. I mean, you know, you see guys out in Mach 4. You know, turning jets, and he's like, man, I can't screw this up because I let every one of those dudes out there sweating, you know, in Mach 4 August, 95 degrees and 80% humidity, I let them down. And so you feel a responsibility to make sure you do it the right way. So.
Yeah, that works the other way. They need the planes. We need to give it to them. So that's, you know, everybody wins. You know, when the plane takes off, comes back, everybody wins. It's a win-win every time. Unless something bad happens. And, you know, I've been through a few crashes, you know, in my career, and it's the saddest thing in the world. And you grow a connection to those aircraft and the crews. So you don't want this to ever happen. These are things that actually happen. So it's something you're prepared for. And they told us for the training mission that we'd have some crashes. We never did. It was only the instructor pilots that had incidents. Small incidents.
Yeah.
It was never the students.
Yeah.
So that's the way life is. I mean, that's just a dangerous game. You know, on the flight line, planes are taxiing in. You know, you're driving a truck or you're walking around. They're loading bombs. It's just like, it's the same thing as a carrier. It's just more space. So, you know, people don't realize, I mean, we do the same thing the Navy does. They're just better landers. I wouldn't even say that.
Yeah.
I'm surprised the planes don't fall apart when they land.
Yeah, you look at the landing gear on a Navy airplane compared to, like, the F-16, I mean, you know, it's twice as beefy, and it has to be because those guys don't know how to flare.
Right. Yeah, we had A-7s, and, you know, they're built that way so that you can land. You can squat. It's a squat landing gear. And, I mean, that's the way they're designed. I saw an article yesterday. Somebody was saying the Navy lands like this and the Air Force lands like this. I said, hey, they're two different aircraft with two different purposes, and the reason that's like that is because of where they land. They're not going to do a large rollout or anything. They're just going to squat on the deck. You got to land that plane. You got to get it down now. You can't have a flare. Come on. So I write back and say, this guy was like, he just assumes things. So there are other people on there saying, no, this is a Navy jet. That's why. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter anyway. They're all for the same fight. I mean, there's no difference when you go to war. You guys are flying with Navy guys as well and Marines. So
yeah.
And other countries. There's other countries there too. And the Dutch are there some places, and then the British. The British are always there. Those guys are crazy.
Yep.
You ever see what they do? Oh my God.
Yeah. I remember when they were taking the Jags off out of Turkey, and I forget how long the runway was there at Incirlik. I think it was 8,000 feet or so, and they used 8,001 foot of that runway.
No,
I mean, you're just like, man, is this dude going to, you know, every time they take off, you're like, he's not going to make it. He's not gonna, and they pull that gear up and climb away slowly. I don't know. It was just scary every time I watched those guys take off, man. Yeah, but
they have
do
something
some crazy
to prove.
Stuff.
They have something to prove. That's why, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember when I was first time to Turkey, they were the rumors were or the, they said that they were doing touch and goes on the Iraqi runways. That's how crazy they are.
Yeah. Yeah, that's classic British humor.
Yes. Yeah, those are probably the most amusing people to be with. And they'll give you tours of their aircraft, tornadoes and everything. But at night, watch out. They're all getting drunk. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I learned very early on in my career, do not ever try to drink gin with a Brit. You'll lose every single time.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, that's the kind of dark side. And all the pilots back in the 80s when I first got in, they're not around anymore. So, yeah. They show up, you know, a little inebriated sometimes, and just on stateside. So, and they put that 100% oxygen on. But you know, every it's the ops thing, I'm sure. But you know, and especially when they have people from out of town. So, I mean, it's a big brotherhood, and it takes a lot of skill and a lot of stuff to get stuff done. You know, it takes a lot of talent to make this thing work. That's what I'm trying to say. It takes a lot of talent, takes a lot of dedication. And every time you pack up and you go back home, it's worth it. And that's the other thing. You're gone a long time. You're missing your family. And there's a lot of hardships. There's a lot of withdrawal when you get back. People don't really understand that. But I don't know if I want to bring up Sonny on this one, but there have been bad things that have happened in your career in I don't know if you want to talk about that or not. It's up to you.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I can. That was probably one of the darkest days of my life, was that night, actually. You know, and as a combat pair, I mean, you fly, you pretty much, you know, you do everything. You work out together, you eat together, you fly together, you debrief together. I mean, everything. You know, and then you go up and just another routine sortie, and then you know, come back and not there, and that was tough. And you know, there's I don't fully understand what happened. I mean, they talked about, you know, as it always is, pilot error, and that's just kind of the catch-all. I don't buy that. I think, you know, something happened to that jet that caused him to have issues, and I don't know. We'll have to wait till the big debrief in the sky one day to figure out where
right.
it went down.
Right.
But I don't buy that. I don't buy that. So, but you know, it's it's hard to believe it's been 15 years. It'll be 15 years this June 15th.
And I think they named a building after him or something. Yeah, I know, it's unbelievable. I dealt with him at Springfield and even in Toledo. You know, I think he fired the EPU in Alpena while he was taxiing.
Nice.
And turned the plane off.
I think you dealt with him. That's about how it was with Sonny.
Yeah, he was a great guy and everything. I mean, he was awesome, and we got along. Guy, he was one of the nice pilots. There's pilots that are nice, and there's some that are not. And I mean, that's the thing. You keep separated from the pilots, and that's the way it should be. I like that. I mean, it's military rank. So
right.
I have no problem with that. That's discipline right there. And it's the same thing with the NCOs, the senior NCOs, and the airmen. Yeah, that's how you do it. They call you sir. You know? So there's order. There's no chaos. And that's how we operated.
Yeah.
In perfect order. But, we had all kinds of incidents. Hydrazine. Yeah, that's the other thing. I got hit by that stuff twice. So there's rocket fuel in these F-16s for emergency power when, you know, you lose your engine. That's your power for the aircraft, and that stuff is dangerous. So that's the danger of a mechanic. I even had one fire on me when we were doing a test run. Big clunk, and there it was. So you have to go to the hospital, get blood drawn, and then, it's not fun. But then you got to worry about what's going to happen in the future. So there's a lot of dangerous chemicals you work with as a mechanic. And just a lot of things that could happen. You could lose your fingers. It's just amazing that I got through 30 years. So I'm very thankful for that.
I don't think people realize just how sharp the trailing edge surfaces of the F-16 are. I mean, like, you're going through your walker, I always made sure I had my hand on the trailing edge flaps because those things are razor sharp. The pitot boom. I watched an intel dude basically take a core sample of his forehead on the pitot boom because we got scrambled, landed, we're turning the jets, we're going to go again. He's like, sir, can I? Because they had to get information. I'm like, you can get whatever you can get while I'm doing my walk around, but that's all I have. I'm not trying to be a jerk. We're going to go fly again. He's like, no, that's fine. So he's walking, not paying attention. He's writing stuff. I'm telling him down. And he goes, I mean, forehead first into that pitot boom. That pitot boom is no kidding, razor sharp. And he kind of staggers back. I look, it was a perfect dot right in the middle of his forehead where he just took a core of his forehead out. And the really funny part, it's not funny, but I'm like, oh, well, now I have to get that out of there because I can't, it's going to foul my pitot static system. So
right.
I'm like reaching out with my pen trying to get this dude's forehead out of my pitot boom.
Wow, incredible.
It's just the kind of stuff that happens that, you know, people don't ever know. I mean, they have in their mind what it's like to go fly a Comet. The stuff that happens that you're just like, no one's going to believe me if I tell you this. It's the truth.
Yeah, you got the canards there too, and you got other surfaces. You know, people like the two that stick down under the nose. People have been bit by that many times. So it's in your back, or if it's a panel or something. It's just like it's a disaster waiting to happen. People get injured there if they don't pay attention. And it's like, you know, you ever seen an engine run with the panel open?
Yeah,
the engine bay panel. That engine is running at, I can't remember how many RPM, but this thing is going fast. It's like some kind of gear drive you see in the bottom of a truck, but this thing is trucking fast. You put your hand up there, it's gone. Your arm's going to go with it. So I was always fearful when I worked on that. You got to be very careful when things are running and moving. And you're talking about, you got this big fuel tank with, you know, feeding the electromechanical machine, this afterburning engine, sometimes you'll start and there's a fireball in the back. Coochie got to put it out.
Yeah.
So, but I learned so much from doing that and carried it on to where I work now, you know, for the Air Force. I was working in the Afghanistan program. I understand all that, the mechanics and the engine stuff. It's a good skill to have. Just like you have a skill, you could become an airline pilot easy, pretty easy. So, but I understand. Tell us what your real job is now.
Oh, what I'm doing now?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a physical therapist at the Ann Arbor VA, working with veterans there. It's been awesome, man. I love it. It helps being a veteran because there's instantly that rapport, that trust, that common ground. A lot of our guys are Vietnam era right now, and they did not have the best experience when they came back. You know, honestly, I feel guilty about that. When I came back, I couldn't buy a drink at Loma Linda's, man. I would leave there with a credit most days. And you know, those guys didn't have that. They came back, they were cussed at, they were, you know, treated poorly, and so even now, you know, in 2022, those guys are still leery, and you know, they have a hard time trusting, and you know, so I think for some folks it's very hard to trust. And you know, being a veteran and having served and been in combat and that kind of stuff, it's been immensely helpful in getting these guys to buy into what I'm asking them to do. So, you know, even having been out now for 8 years, you know, my career in the Air Force is still paying dividends as a civilian. So.
Absolutely. Yes. And I remember I'd go out in my uniform, living in Maumee at the time, and then people would buy me stuff. You know, hey, so this guy paid for it for you. Oh, we got it. And it's like, it was awesome. It's awesome. You know, I feel appreciated. I can't imagine how those guys come back and they were spit on at the airport and everything, and people didn't respect them. And then when I got in, we had a lot of Vietnam vets. That's how old I am. That were there. They're older guys. They had so many ribbons on their chest. It was incredible. All the campaigns they did. These are Air Force guys. And I had nothing but respect for the guys and all they did. And the stories they told, the Korean veterans, we had some of those as well.
Yeah.
They took an F-84, and they parked it in front of this gate. And that was the only gun they had, the only ammo. That's what they put it on jacks or something so that they could fire the gun from that. My dad was at the same place. My dad told me that story before, too. So it's incredible.
Yeah, for
Living
sure,
mechanics
man.
In that gun. Yes.
It's just been,
so how many years were you
been,
a pilot? What's that?
16. I was enlisted for 5 and flew for 16.
Wow, that's... And you know what that does to fighter pilots? It gives them gray hair. So I don't know if your hair is gray. So that's the thing.
That's not gray.
Boomers.
I prefer natural highlights, naturally highlighted.
And the guys on the guys on the refueling the tankers, those guys, every one of them, all the boomers I've ever known that I worked with, all have white hair. So, I mean, it's probably a lot of stress. So they go a lot
of
places.
They have
they're
young,
always on the
young,
road.
Young dudes, they've got young guys on the boom that scare the heck out of them. I was one of those guys when I was that was the one thing I really wasn't good at in the F-16 was air refueling until later in my career.
Oh, really?
But you're hanging out 10 feet away from, you know, a couple hundred thousand pounds of jet fuel. The F-16 is smart. When you open the AR door, it reduces the control sensitivity significantly, but it's still it's very uncomfortable to be that close to a big airplane, you know. And, towards the end, you do it in your sleep, but that was one of the hardest things to learn in that jet because, you know, folks may or may not know, the air refueling door sits well aft of the pilot. It's well behind you, about 8 feet or so. And so, yeah, you can't see what you're doing. You're just flying off lights on the underside of the KC-135 or KC-10. So, yeah, that was, you know, you just have to, you know, do the opposite of what your body's telling you to do, and that's relax. I mean, your body's like, get me away from this thing, but you have to, you know, just take, try to relax. It's not so bad, but not fun.
So now they have the KC-46, which is the 767.
Yeah.
That's a big plane. And they're refueling, boom, there's nobody back there. They're sitting up front, and they have a camera, some kind of camera. They go at it, or a virtual thing. So they're moving forward, you know. This is a good thing, and greater range. Greater capability. Everything adds up to greater capability. We can do whatever we need to do. We can do it, and we have the aircraft. So that's always good. And
yeah,
I said, sure. young kids would go in there, become boomers, and next thing you know, all white hair. It was a few years later. So, I could imagine working on anything but fighters. I would not be happy. Things are slower with the other cargo and everything. And to me, it seems boring. It's not the same. So you got to have that. You have that, it's got to be something you love, something you like to do. And
yeah, absolutely.
I'm sure you probably wouldn't like to fly a C-130. I'm sure you wouldn't, or anything else. It's just,
maybe an AC-130.
Yeah, right.
It's got
right.
guns on it.
Right. So that's why, you know, people say, like you, I think you mentioned before, become an airline pilot, and it's like boring. But you fly like a few times a day. But there's a lot. It's complicated. I'll just say that. It's a complicated relationship. But, you know, they're still flying airplanes,
sure.
And that's why people do it.
Yeah.
But it's
aviation.
You know, I learned so much from aviation from there, and I carried it to American Airlines, and now I'm working on programs for other aircraft. So that's my whole life. I enjoy it. I can't live without it. It's something that I really enjoy. I can't imagine not doing it. But I'm smart enough to know that I can't fly an airplane because I'd crash it. I don't have that kind of skill. I don't care how fast or slow it is. That's not me. But I know that. Some people don't. They have a lot of money. They buy it and they crash. You know, if I had like millions of dollars, I wouldn't buy an airplane. So you got to know your limits, and that's a good thing. That's a great thing. If you have the skills and ability, just do it. Other than that, I think this war might be quieting down or terminating. I don't think there's really nothing going on at this point. Not much. You see a lot of things on TV, and sometimes TV doesn't show you what's really going on out there. So,
sure.
Because my thesis is this: they could take over the entire country on a drill weekend, Russia. Because way back in the fields of Russia and all the airstrips and everything, they could bring thousands of aircraft and finish it off. I don't think that's their goal. I don't know what they're. We'll never know. That's not for us to know. Nobody knows what the military does until after it happens. So
true.
There's a lot of things we don't know. So that's just my thesis. I don't know what you think about that, because I don't see it all out offensive.
Yeah, I'll be completely honest with you. I try not to watch the news. It just
yeah.
You know, it breaks my heart, man. I mean, like, to see, you know, brother against brother, I mean, yeah, it's, you know, I don't know. And, like, a few times I watched it, I've seen some things with, you know, civilians being harmed intentionally. And my heart can't handle that.
Right.
It breaks my heart, man. That was, like, the one thing we strove beyond, you know, is to make sure that we're only if we're going kinetic and using lethal means, we do everything in our power to eliminate any sort of civilian issues, you know, casualties, that kind of thing. And then to watch these guys, and they kind of go in there, and just no respect for human lives and the countrymen. I mean, they were, it'd be like literally if the state of Georgia broke off from the United States and we invaded them. You know, I mean, they were still at one point Americans. They were still, you know,
yeah.
To see that, just I try not to watch it, man. It's just, I try to keep.
Yeah, I don't either.
Try to keep away from it. Yeah.
So. And it's brother against brother, just like the Civil War, and they used to be part of the same entity. So, you know, we just, this is something that I can't even imagine that here. Like you said, I can't imagine that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure, man.
Even though we were at war with Michigan from Ohio, so, years ago.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Toledo's the prize that Ohio won, apparently.
I think we lost.
Yeah, you're right.
So I'm happy. I'm proud of the guys in Toledo are doing great. You know, they're a lot more involved. They cut all these units out in the past. And a lot of the onus is on them now, and all these other guard units and active duty units. So I remember, I don't know if you know this or not. Well, did you go to Africa?
Yeah.
With us? Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, that's the weirdest thing. You're the only person I could actually talk to about this, verify this, because we were over there. We had to be moved to the red line in another country. So
yeah.
The entire time we're going there, there was no active duty flying anywhere unless they're activated because of, I think it was sequestration.
Yeah.
Nobody could fly. That's the National Guard was the only Air Force the Air Force had for a long time, for months, maybe even longer, I don't know, but that was it. We were the defense. We were the Air Force. And a lot of people don't know that. So even, I mean, we went to Spain and those planes are parked, they would taxi out, Marines, Air Force, but they could not, and the foreign military, they were flying, but they could not take off because of the budget, the Obama budget that was out there. So now we go to Africa, we're the only ones flying, unless they were activated, active duty, we were it. In the entire world. And then we're about to be put on the red line. So think about that.
Yeah.
That's pretty deep.
That was crazy, man. We were on a deployment from a deployment. I mean, we packed up hastily from Djibouti and flew in Jordan and I won't go into beyond that, you know, what was going on, but
right.
I mean, I'm sure it's happened, but never in my career, you know. And
right.
You know, the biggest thing was when we got in country, somebody forgot the coffee maker. And that place was about to burn down. Have you ever seen an ops squad
right.
without a coffee pot? I'm telling you, it's not pretty.
Yeah. Right. You guys had it made. You were in a palace. We were not. So ops is pretty nice.
Yeah.
But you know, I don't care. I mean, I'm there to use it. That's my mission. I got to do this, right? Nobody cares about that. But just I'm proud of the Guard because they pulled it off. They made it happen. You know,
yeah.
The enemy can't tell who's what or what unit they're from. So, I mean, our guys rocked that whole mission and all that, those sorties and everything. And the California Guard was there refueling. Their C-130s with their HH-60s. I worked with that unit for 2 months. Those guys are awesome. So they do real mission. They go on there and they rescue pilots. And I'm sure you appreciated that. That's what they did. And
absolutely.
So, you know, everybody works together. And I got some friends over there that I knew, which is kind of weird too. But I mean, it's one big family, right? So,
yep.
If you have to go, I can let you go now, or if you want to talk some more, that's no problem either. We have 25 minutes left, and I know you're driving.
Yeah, I've got a little more. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I've got 2 hours and 39 minutes until I'm home. So.
Okay. I used to drive that every weekend, but
to your point, when you're talking about how the guard kind of stepped up, and I mean, you know, when we would go places like Iraq, and we'd show up, we'd, you know, work with the other squadrons. Like there were Shaw was there, you know, other active duty units, and they would look at our letter of X's, which is your pilot qualifications, and be absolutely stunned at how senior we were, how many instructor pilots we had, how many weapons officers we had, you know, how many, you know, and they were basically just like barely holding it together with, you know, 2 and 4 ship flight leads, a very small number of instructor pilots. And, you know, we were truly like our cup was running over. I mean, we had, we'd have 5, 6, 7, 8 instructor pilots, a couple of weapons officers, you know, and they just couldn't believe, you know, how much, you know, experience we had. And I'm like, well, that's, you know, because active duty can be rough, man, and guys don't want to deal with that, so they come to the guard, and, you know. So,
right.
But yeah, we always had a ton of experience. You know, so people, you know, the guard kind of had a rep, you know, 20, 30 years ago as being a bit of a flying club, but, and that went away. Like, that does not exist anymore. It is not how it is. So I want to throw that out there to say that, most of the guard units are very capable, very experienced, probably more so than some of the active duty in most places.
Absolutely, like the guard, if somebody works maintenance or there's a pilot flying for the guard unit, that's what they do. They do that for 20 years plus. Active duty, you might be working on F-16s, and I've seen this happen. Now you're working on KC-135. So your capability and your knowledge is gone. So they keep adding new people and moving people around a little too much. Occasionally you see somebody that stays at a base a little longer, but, and then we would go to the competitions and win all of them. The guard would totally own Gunsmoke out in Las Vegas because the maintenance was not even close. So we had a guy, we had a guy down at Springfield that came, some senior master sergeant, and says, we need to do our phases like the Air Force, or like the Guard does. He's trying to implement a longer phase. They do them in 3 days. And we take 2 months or a month or so to get ours done because we want to be more thorough. So there's a lot of things that are starting to cross over into the active duty for the good. And a lot of Guard people in the reserves are involved in a lot of these projects because they know, these people know what they're doing, and they're pretty skillful at it. And I fixed a lot of active duty aircraft, you know, on overseas trips. so they had trouble.
Oh,
they didn't man them the right way. Shaw Air Force Base, different places. And that's where you shine. And I got job offers from other places, even other guard units, because I helped them out too. And that's what you do.
Yeah.
Because you're all one team. There's no division. But that's what we got to get more of. It's one team, one fight. So that's what it's all about.
Yeah, no, for sure. That's and, you know, the other thing about the guard that's a little different than the active duty is in active duty, you're constantly rotating in and out, 2, 3 years, maybe 4 if you're lucky, and then you're on to your next assignment. You know, whereas in the guard, guys literally will spend their entire career there. So there's kind of a retention of corporate knowledge, if you will, where guys have been there for so long and they know so much and they're able to pass that on to the younger generation, and it just kind of perpetuates itself. And you just don't see that in the active duty, because that's the nature of active duty is that you do your assignment and then you move on. And so, it's just different.
You lose a lot there. And I know guys worked at Shaw for 8 years, F-16, and then they got transferred somewhere else to another aircraft, and they were like, it's like, they were disappointed, because I know this, they were talking about, I know this aircraft, why would they put me there? So some things are random. You're still going to work an aircraft when you know what you're going to work next. And it's okay if you want to get knowledge, but if you want to be ready, I have people that can replace me in my shop that can do the job just as well as I can, and that's what the point is, and for years. So you get good at what you do. You change aircraft, so what? You learn that too. I mean, but you don't disrupt the flow. I think that's a bad idea. And that's why active duty had the same issues. And like I said, I went to Turkey with Lakenese and another unit, Shaw. Yeah, it was Shaw. Another Shaw thing, I think it was. And they only had two people, one senior airman and a tech sergeant, for the entire fleet they had. So we were like, they're asking us for help. So we were fat and happy. We had a lot of people that were capable, and you know, that's what you plan for, you know. So like me over in Africa, I totally injured my knee and I was out of the picture pretty much, and the other guys took over, and you know, and there was nothing unexpected. It was like, we got this. So, and that's how we operated, because it's actually just a big family, you know. That's who we are. That's what we did, and we did it right. Just like they did back in WW2. And I like to go back to that. Yeah.
Yeah, it could be a dysfunctional family at times, but, you know, yeah. What family isn't that way at some point? So.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it could be negative as well. But when it comes down to it, you know what you got to do. And you got to do it. And there's no, I'm a master sergeant, I don't need to work anymore. And that's the other difference with the active duty. You got seniors out there working aircraft, and make staff, you ride in the truck, that doesn't work. You know, you got to keep your experience with everybody else. And that's what I love about the Guard. And you got, there's probably, I'm going to say maybe, I don't know, maybe a third, almost a third are from the active duty, have been active duty before. And they always say, I'm so glad I moved to the Guard.
Yeah,
maybe not that much, but there's a big contingent of people who got out of active duty and they palace chased, and then this is where they are, and they do well.
Yeah.
And just like the pilots have people from active duty. So, and I left the Guard too because,
Go ahead. Oh, go ahead, man. Go ahead.
What I love about the Guard is they'll take your own. Oh, sorry.
You go.
Go ahead.
You go.
You go.
No.
Okay. They take people from their unit and make them their pilots. They don't get random people from who knows where. They know the people. They test them. And then that's the case you had. You're actually working somewhere else in that unit. You were in the, what shop was that? Parachute shop?
Aircrew life support, yeah.
Oh, life support.
Yep.
So there's opportunities, and next thing you know, you're a fighter pilot. Well, not that fast, but you know what I mean. And I see that, and I love when they do that, because, like, that's great. They promote their own, like, Todd Kopic, his son is a fighter pilot, I believe, now.
Yeah.
And
it's
amazing.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many guys. Roy Poor, Greece, he was a crew chief. Albie Vollmer. I mean, there's a ton of guys. I mean, we just, you know, we pluck a lot of crew chiefs. You know, there's just so many of those guys. And you know, because you can vet guys. I mean, like, you know, you know them. You know, is this going to be a guy I'm going to be basically joined at the hip with for 4 months over in Iraq, you know, or am I going to want to, like, put a pillow over this dude's face when he's sleeping? Like, you know, I mean, you kind of weed out the guys that, you know, aren't team players, or that are, you know, maybe just not good dudes. You know, they might be decent pilots, but you know, you have to be a team player. You have to be a guy that, you know, people want to be around, because, you know, it that's a big part of it. I mean, you have to be able to play nice in the sandbox, you know.
Absolutely. You know, you probably don't know this, but we did the same thing over in the maintenance squadron, because sometimes you get people that the recruiters give you and they don't work out in the first hitch, and we might recommend or suggest maybe you shouldn't, you know, re-enlist, because it's that important. You know, if you got to have a team, you can rely on somebody. And my measure was, I can send you on a trip by yourself and you can fix the airplane. If people can't do that, or they don't have the aptitude, some people you get, they don't know anything about hand tools. They have no idea, and they never learn. Those are the people you can't keep. And so there's a reason, because when it comes down to it, they got to have your back, and that's what the Army does as well. And it's a necessary thing. You have to thin the people that aren't helping you. They're working against you in one way or another. So, I mean, in some cases, it's so extreme that there's no way. There's no way. You haven't learned. You've been here a couple of years. Haven't learned a thing. So it's not like everybody gets a ride at all. It's like you have to perform. You have to hit those milestones. And if you can't, then you have to go. And that's the mechanism we have, so we keep everybody up to speed and everybody working for the team, everybody with the same mindset. And if you're not with that, then you're not going to be there very long. So it's not a, it's not something that's granted to you. You have to work for it.
Absolutely. And the point I was going to make earlier when we were kind of stepping on each other there is just I think that the active duty has realized that, because they are doing a lot now of having, you know, integrating active duty in with guard units it started happening when I was getting out, and then I think it's, I can't speak to it exactly because I haven't been there, but it sounds like that's really, really taken off. They've got quite a few more active duty guys that will rotate in and kind of benefit from, you know, seasoning at a lot of the guard bases where they can have that senior experience where you got a lot of instructors and guys that can, you know, help pass on that information. And then they go back to the Air Force and kind of disseminate that out as well. So I think even the Air Force itself has realized that, hey, you know, there's a lot of benefits to, you know, to the Guard and what we offer and how we do our mission. So.
Yeah, you're right. And unfortunately, sometimes it's us versus them. You know how it is. Even day shift and night shift, it's just human. That's what humans do.
Yeah.
Like Springfield, we had a night shift and we had a day shift. It was always us and them. But we're all working on the same team. We go into deployment. But, you know, that's psychology. That happens everywhere. Unfortunately.
Oh, yeah.
Unfortunately, it does. You know, I maybe that's a human thing. I don't know. But, yeah we're yeah. You rely on everybody. I mean, you can't do it without everybody. You can't fly a plane without mechanics. You don't have a job without the pilot. So,
right.
But so what's it like to go Moth 2?
Well, I don't know. I've never done it.
What's it like to take off an afterburner?
That is a kick in the pants because, you know, the faster you go, the faster you go faster. So as you accelerate, the aircraft accelerates faster. And so you it definitely throws you back in the seat quite a bit. You know, I was trying to think when you asked that question, I don't really remember how fast I ever went. I think I was like 1.5, 1.6 Mach. Like, that's about it. The placard limits are a little over twice the speed of sound on the jet. But there's really no reason to ever go that fast. Like, I... unless I was running away from somebody.
I watched Top Gun.
Yeah. But, so I think...
So how close
1.6 is like... How close is
1.6,
flying the
yeah.
Top Gun? Not even close, man.
Right. So what's the 1.6 like?
It depends on what... How, you know, if you're at high altitude, you really almost don't perceive it. You know, when we give incentive rides, everybody's like, well, I want to go supersonic. I'm like, here's the deal. You won't know it unless I tell you. You know, I'm like, oh, hey, we're supersonic now.
Right.
And all we'll do is waste gas. And so, you know, there's a lot of other
right.
really cool stuff we could be doing, you know, that get you more bang for your buck, so to speak, than, you know, just saying you went supersonic. But, you know, if you're lucky and it's really, like, humid out, you might get, like, that little donut of condensation that goes around where you're passing through the Mach, but that's very rare. And so, you know, I just like, all right, hey, we're 1.0. Congrats, we're supersonic. All right, let's get the throttle back and go do some real fun stuff. So, you know, high altitude, you don't feel it. Low altitude, then, yeah, definitely. I mean, you don't even have to go supersonic low altitude to feel the rush. I mean, we would do our low levels at, you know, 480 knots, and then a target run at 540, and that's plenty fast.
Yeah,
you're trying to keep up with the jet and make all your get all your switches and everything set up and find the target, do your pop-up and all that kind of stuff. So, and, you know, you're always worried about smacking a bird or something low altitude.
Yeah, so, bird strike.
Yeah, well, you remember Shadow, our ops group
yeah.
commander? He hit
yeah.
like a 12-pound turkey vulture. And I think, fortunately for him, it hit the bottom of the intake lip, split in half. Then there's that inlet vein. Hit that, split that in half, hit the nose cone, buckled that in, and kind of broke the bird apart into pieces. So, you know, if he had taken that straight down the chute, it would have probably trashed the engine that he had had to eject. But, you know.
Yeah, that's the one that was at Wright-Patterson.
Yeah.
In a hangar. Yeah, I've seen,
yeah.
I saw the damage on that one. Incredible.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, he
that's
hit
scary.
That one. It was a big bird.
Yeah. Yeah, that had to be a huge bird. That was incredible. It was down there for months, I think, for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, I was actually flying as his number two when it happened, and I remember him just jacking the nose of that airplane up, and he's like, hit a bird! And we ended up snapping up. I forget where even we went, but, you know, he was worried, because you don't know. You don't know, you know, what, you know, if there's been damage or how long it'll hold together, or, you know, you just don't know, so you just got to put it on the ground as soon as you can. But Shadow was a pretty cool customer, but he had definitely had his adrenaline going that day, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
sure.
a serious situation. Yeah, that's one thing you don't want to happen. Just like, remember Oshkosh where the ECS system overwhelmed the pilot?
Yeah.
It was Alabama. Well, my thing is, why didn't you just turn it off? Because, this
don't
is all, never mind. Yeah. I know that system a little too well. So, Alabama.
Yeah.
Air Guard. Yeah. So, yeah. Oh, well. So, yeah.
Well,
this is
over,
a different culture. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say real fast. I was in Iraq, and I believe it was a Shaw jet. I was sitting up at the soft, sitting soft that night in the tower, and, you know, doing standard stuff, checking NOTAMs, weather, this, that, calling their divert bases and stuff. And I hear, I forget his call sign, the guy lights his afterburner, takes off, and, like, the main fuel lines of the engine ruptures, and it just started dumping mm-hmm. out 40,000 pounds per hour of JP-8 on the runway, and it lit. And I just remember it went from pitch black to, like, daylight, and there's this, like, 1,000-foot wall of flame about 30 feet high where all this
wow.
JP-8 is caught on fire. And so the pilot initiates his, like, grounding. He rips the throttle back, honks on the brakes, and, you know, I'm sure there's some compression, time compression going on, but I just remember thinking to myself, there is no way he's going to get out of this airplane in time before he's, you know, engulfed. And so as he's unstrapping, the jet departs the prepared surface, the nose gear collapses, and I just...
Wow.
And I can't see because it's dark, but I'm like, you know, I'm praying for this guy. I'm like, please tell me he got out of there. Please tell me he got out of there. And so this jet is just, you know, within seconds, not, you know, of coming to a stop, it's a fireball. And pretty soon I hear chatter on the radio saying, hey, we got the pilot. We got him. He's running. We can't stop him. And this guy just, I mean, he just put that aircraft on his tail and ran as fast as he could. And he made it out. I still don't know. If you had told me that was going to happen, I don't think I could have got out of that aircraft in time. And this dude made it happen, and thank goodness, because, you know, that would not be a good way to go. But it was just, you know, the kind of amazing stuff you see. You know, the jet was a total loss. I mean, hydrazine was cooking off. They had a Mavericks on it. Even the PGU-28, the 20-millimeter rounds were cooking off like popcorn. And I remember the fire crew, the fire chief is like, they're on station trying to put this thing out. And I get a hold of him. I'm like, dude, get away from the jet. And because, I mean, there's all kinds. There's the hydrazine, there's the fuel, there's the bombs, the bullets, the missiles, all this stuff. And he says, sir, with all due respect, this is our job, this is what we do. I said, I get that, but there is nothing on that jet that is worth one of your dudes even getting a sliver in his finger for. If that thing's a total loss, don't put your guys at risk unnecessarily. You know, just get them away. Let it burn.
Right. Let it burn.
And, like, I literally, you know, and he was fighting me on it. I said, listen, I said, I am acting with the ops group commander's authority. I'm ordering you to walk away from that jet. And he did. And then we came out and we talked afterwards. And I was like, man, here's the deal. Like, if there was a pilot in there, or if there was something you were trying to do that was worth risking your guys for, I would tell you to press. But that, you know, the pilot was out, the jet was trashed, it was you know, literally melting the aluminum.
Wow.
You know, why would you
incredible.
Risk, you know, don't risk your people, you know? And he's like, you know, you're right, but, you know, heat of the moment, this is what we trained all our lives for, and they wanted to do their job. And I'm like, man, that's not worth it. We got lucky, we didn't lose a pilot. We sure as hell don't want to lose one of your firefighters. So
absolutely. Hey, we have 3 minutes left. I got to ask you a question that only you can probably answer. Back when the F-16 slipped over at the Dayton Airport when it landed, we were there. We were watching the whole thing. It was a practice, I think, and we watched it from the airline, you know, place, the hangar. How in the world did he get that thing flipped over?
I could not tell you.
It was raining.
I don't know.
It was a D model.
Yeah.
I think the same thing. He must have hired
maybe he put
he
it.
Must, yeah.
I honestly have no idea. I don't know. I've put him on hard before. I've landed hard before. I have never come anywhere near flipping one over. Unless he just kind of reached back on the stick and one of the wings stalled and the other one didn't, and I don't know, man.
Well, he had a crew chief in the back seat for a ride.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking he was hot dogging or something. I don't know how he did it. Anyway, he was fired eventually. The commander was too. And like I said, we saw that happen, but we couldn't see that at the end of the runway. We didn't know that it flipped over. We just saw it land. So.
Yeah.
So,
I wish I could tell you, man. No idea.
Okay. So, 2 minutes left. I thank you so much for coming on and appreciate it. It's always a pleasure to have you here. And like I said, I want to get you together with the Vietnam pilot who spent 5 years in Hanoi Hilton so you guys can trade things. And it's good to talk about the other side. This is the other side for us mechanics. So we like to hear things that happen. So be safe on your drive, and tell your girlfriend and son I said hello. If you're listening, hi. Nice to meet you.
Will do. All right, man. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. I appreciate that. So you have a good night and safe drive.
All right, you too. Take care.
All right.
All right.
Bye. So we have 90 seconds left, and that was fascinating. I learned things from people, all kinds of people that are on this program. And Brad is an exceptional person, and I worked with him for a while there. And he always got stuff together, helped me out with the Pro Super and all that. But we worked together. So our next guest, I'm going to actually record this on Saturday, is a science fiction writer. And things to do with zombies and everything. So we'll see how that goes. So anyway, you guys take care, and thanks for listening. And have a nice weekend, because we're out.